Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and I'm glad that you've chosen to join the program today, wherever you are. And I hope, as always, that it will bring happiness, benefit, and well-being to your life. Talking about happiness, I came across a 2010 article from the New York Times archives called When the Mind Wanders, Happiness Also Strays. It seems to have something to do with what we were talking about last week, which, as you remember, was the dissatisfied mind. Happiness implies a satisfied mind, even if it's only for a very short time. So unhappiness implies a dissatisfied mind. And what John Teary, the author of the article, found was that a lot of our dissatisfaction comes from letting the mind go walkabout. Now, didn't the Buddha say this 2,600 odd years ago? In any case, before we have a look at the article, let's set our motivation for today as we usually do. And let that motivation be bodhicitta, the wish to attain full and perfect enlightenment, not only for our own sakes, but for the benefit of all beings everywhere. Now, if that's too vast for you, at least keep in mind your own enlightenment. Thank you. John Teary opens his article with a little experiment. He asks his readers to close their eyes for a few seconds and let their mind go wherever it wants to. So let's do that for a short while. John Teary opens his article with a little experiment. He asks his readers to close their eyes for a few seconds and let their mind go wherever it wants to. Now let's do that for a short while. He then brings us back to the hypothesis of his experiment, which is that, as he describes it, wherever your mind went, the South Seas, your job, your lunch, your unpaid bills, that daydreaming is not likely to make you as happy as focusing intensely on the rest of this column will. But then he writes, I'm not so sure I believe this prediction, but I can assure you it is based on an enormous amount of daydreaming catalogued in the current issue of Science. Now that is Science magazine, not the general field of science. Using an iPhone app called Track Your Happiness, psychologists at Harvard contacted people around the world at random intervals to ask how they were feeling, what they were doing, and what they were thinking. The least surprising finding, based on 250,000 responses from more than 2,200 people, was that the happiest people in the world were the ones in the midst of enjoying sex. Or at least, they were enjoying it until the iPhone interrupted. The researchers are not sure how many of them stooped to pick up the phone and how many waited until afterwards to respond. Nor, unfortunately, is there any way to gauge what thoughts happy, unhappy murderers went through their partners' minds when they tried to resume. When asked to rate their feelings on a scale of 0 to 100, with 100 being very good, the people having sex gave an average rating of 90. That was a good 15 points higher than the next best activity, exercising, which was followed closely by conversation, listening to music, taking a walk, eating, praying and meditating, cooking, shopping, taking care of one's children, and reading. Near the bottom of the list were personal grooming, commuting, and working. When asked their thoughts, the people in flagrante were models of concentration. Only 10% of the time did their thoughts stray from their endeavors. But when people were doing anything else, their minds wandered at least 30% of the time, and as much as 65% of the time. That was recorded during moments of personal grooming, clearly a less than scintillating enterprise. On average, throughout all the 250,000 responses, minds were wandering 40% of the time. That figure surprised the researchers, Matthew Killingsworth and Daniel Gilbert. I find it kind of weird now to look down a crowded street and realize that half the people aren't really there, Dr. Gilbert says. You might suppose that if my people's minds wander while they're having fun, then those stray thoughts are liable to be about something pleasant. And that was indeed the case with those happy campers having sex. But for the other 99.5% of the people, there was no correlation between the joy of the activity and the pleasantness of their thoughts. Even if you're doing something that's really enjoyable, Mr. Killingsworth said, that doesn't seem to protect against negative thoughts. The rate of mind wandering is lower for more enjoyable activities, but when people wander, they're just as likely to wander towards negative thoughts. Now, whatever people were doing, whether it was having sex or reading or shopping, they tended to be happier if they focused on the activity instead of thinking about something else. In fact, whether and where their minds wandered was a better predictor of happiness than what they were doing. If you ask people to imagine winning the lotteries, Dr. Gilbert says, they typically talk about the things they would do. I'd go to Italy, I'd buy a boat, I'd lie on the beach. And they rarely mention the things they would think. But our data suggest that the location of the body is much less important than the location of the mind, and that the former has surprisingly little influence on the latter. The heart goes where the head takes it, and neither cares much about the whereabouts of the feet. Still, even if people are less happy when their minds wander, which causes which? Could the mind wandering be a consequence rather than a cause of unhappiness? To investigate cause and effect, the Harvard psychologists compared each person's moods and thoughts as the day went on. They found that if someone's mind wandered at, say, 10 in the morning, then at 10:15, that person was likely to be less happy than at 10, perhaps because of those stray thoughts. But if people were in a bad mood at 10, they weren't more likely to be worrying or daydreaming at 10:15. We see evidence for mind wandering causing unhappiness, but no evidence for unhappiness causing mind wandering, Mr. Killingsworth says. This result may disappoint daydreamers, but it's in keeping with the religious and philosophical admonitions to be here now, as the yogi Ram Dass titled his 1971 book. The phrase later became the title of a George Harrison song warning that a mind that likes to wander around the corner is an unwise mind. What psychologists call flow, immersing your mind fully in activity, has long been advocated by non-psychologists. Life is not long, Samuel Johnson said, and too much of it must not pass in idle deliberation how it shall be spent. Henry Ford was more blunt. Idleness warps the mind. The iPhone results jibe nicely with one of the favorite sayings of William F. Buckley, Jr. Industry is the enemy of melancholy. Alternatively, you could interpret the iPhone data as support for the philosophical dictum of Bobby McFerrin, don't worry, be happy. Tierney says that the unhappiness brought on by mind wandering came largely from the mind wandering to unpleasant topics. Such stray thoughts, he writes, made people more miserable than commuting or working or any other activity. But then he goes on to say that stray thoughts on neutral topics resulted in only a little below the overall average in happiness. And people who daydreamed about pleasant topics were actually a bit above average on the happiness scale, though they didn't match the happiness of people whose minds were not wandering. But then he drops a little bombshell. He writes, there are times, of course, when unpleasant thoughts are the most useful thoughts. Happiness in the moment is not the only reason to do something, says Jonathan Schooler, a psychologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His research has shown that mind wandering can lead people to creative solutions of problems, which could make them happier in the long term. Now, that might be so, but the Harvard researchers found that over the several months of their study, and I quote, the more frequent mind wanderers remained less happy than the rest. And the moral, at least for the short term, seems to be, you stray, you pay. So, to paraphrase Tierney, if you've been able to stay focused on this discussion up to now, perhaps you're happier than when we did the daydreaming experiment at the beginning. If not, you can go back to daydreaming starting now. Or, says Tierney, you could try focusing on something else that is now, at long last, scientifically guaranteed to improve your mood. Just make sure you turn the phone off. I wonder what Namkar Pal, the author of Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, the text that we've been following, with thought of all this. It fits pretty nicely into where we have reached in the text, that is, consideration of the six sufferings as part of the preliminary practices. Remember, the first of the six is uncertainty, and the second, dissatisfaction, which we've started discussing last week. John Tierney has widened our understanding of the dissatisfied mind, and in a blog on the Huffington Post, the psychotherapist, yoga therapist, and ex-filmmaker Ira Israel suggests how we can address and overcome, at least to some extent, this mind. His solutions may not lead to full enlightenment, but they can certainly help us on the way to get there. So let's check it out. He calls his article Mindful Happiness, 10 Remedies for Subtle Incessant Dissatisfaction, and precedes it with a couple of relevant quotes. Happiness cannot be pursued. You do not find happiness, happiness finds you. It is not an end in itself, but a byproduct of other activities, often arriving when it is least expected. And that's by Mick Brown. And also, it is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society, by Jiddu Krishnamurti. Israel then writes, I spent the last 15 years reading every self-help, spiritually made simple, happiness for dummies, mindfulness, yoga, DIY psychotherapy book known to God and man, to reduce thousands of years of religion, psychology, and philosophy to a 1,000-word blog would be unwise, if not vulgar. And yet, once you parse the semantic differences between the sundry religions, psychologies and philosophies, and the plethora of derivative transformational workshops, like the ones I teach, and therapeutic modalities, like the ones I use with patients, it's easy to see how many of the problems we encounter are culturally contingent, and how many of the proposed solutions are tantamount to serving old wine in new bottles. Now here's what I've learnt, what I teach, and what I live. And then he gives us 10 pointers, starting with number 10, pursuing happiness actually causes misery. He says, the irony is that if you want to be happy, you need to release your desire to be happy. For desire is the root of all suffering, according to the Buddha, and happiness, when it occurs, is actually a byproduct and not a direct result of particular actions. The best way to engender and maximize the byproduct of happiness is to embrace a lifestyle and incorporate tools that are scientifically proven to keep you at the high end of your happiness spectrum, such as meditation, yoga, exercise, ample sleep, community, self-discipline, secure attachments, intimacy, authentic communications, delayed gratification, and eating to fuel your body, instead of eating for self-destructive psychological emotional reasons. If you live in America, then you've been raised to believe that the pursuit of happiness is an inalienable right, which was grand and appetizing for the oppressed pilgrims who settled these fine shores many moons ago. However, we now know that pursuing happiness causes misery because your mind is akin to a hedonic treadmill. As soon as a desire is sated, it is replaced by another desire. If you think you'll be happy when you get a new car, house, partner, or job, scientific studies inform us that those shiny new objects lose their allure in 12 to 18 months. Then he comes to number 9, release expectations. He says, the future is a void. One of the primary features of our minds is to imagine potential future scenarios in an attempt to stave off possible traumatic surprises. This defense mechanism, which was so essential to helping you survive your highly competitive and often disappointing childhood, is now hindering you from showing up authentically in the relationships that are integral to your healing journey. Thus, learn how to observe your mind's incessant leaping into possible future scenarios and gently correct it by teaching it to be here now, in capitals. In number 8 is short and sweet. He writes, your mind was trained to want more, better, different. If you want to be happy, you need to untrain it and replace those woulda, coulda, shouldas with gratitude and acceptance. And gratitude and acceptance are in big capital letters. Number 7, he says, is the mind plagued by irrational thought? Something is wrong. I'm different from other people. I don't feel safe. Everyone has experienced traumas, and our minds have clung to those past events and kept them alive as if they were still happening. Forgiveness and acceptance are tools that we must continuously employ in order to release or at least reframe past karmas. And once again, forgiveness and acceptance, big capital letters. Then number 6 is similar to number 7, but instead of being plagued by the thought something is wrong, your mind is plagued by the irrational thought something must be wrong with me. He writes, children assimilate negative energy around them by having the voices in their heads say, there must be something wrong with me. If I'd been different, then mommy and daddy wouldn't have gotten divorced. My brother wouldn't have died. My best friend wouldn't have moved away. Fill in the blank blank happened. It is just as easy for the narrative to be, my life is perfect. It's not my fault that my parents got divorced, my brother died, my best friend moved away, fill in the blank blank happened. Reframe your narrative in order to eliminate the resentments. Resentment equals this should not have happened that your mind creates. He goes on to say, you have an internal barometer that was shaped before you could speak that either informs you that the world is an inherently scary place with finite resources or a loving place of abundance. This is number 5. Your way of being in the world, your core issues, and your disposition are not as dynamic as you have been informed to believe. The current wave of neuroplasticity sweeping self-help books is belied by false syllogisms such as brain cells are malleable. Meditation relaxes people, thus meditation changes brain cells. This is inaccurate and misleading, he claims. Tools such as meditation were not and cannot be designed to change particular brain cells. Specifically, meditation was designed to alleviate suffering by learning to transcend or tame the restless mind. Why is the mind restless? Because your society has trained you to think more, better, different will make you happier, that you are not safe and must keep your guard up and adrenaline pumping or you'll get hurt, and there must be something wrong with you. However, it is equally possible to train your mind to believe that you are not presently in danger, there's nothing wrong with you, and your life is unfolding exactly as it should be unfolding. So don't worry about your prefrontal cortex or synapses or neurons or limbic system or anything that you cannot directly experience through your 5 senses. Worry about showing up and being present for your life. For number 4, he uses the equation self-discipline equals self-worth. He says, we have an epidemic of people in our culture who suffer from low self-worth, low self-esteem, and negative self-talk that manifest as alcoholism, infidelity, gambling addictions, shopping addictions, eating disorders, and a host of other afflictions. Whenever patients think that their accomplishments are not good enough, I ask, whose voice is that? Usually, it's a teacher's or parent's or sibling's voice. No bonobo ever thought, yes, I'm enjoying this delicious fruit right now, but I'll only truly be happy when I have an entire plantation. If you suffer from low self-worth and want to correct this, then cultivate personal discipline. Make commitments such as eliminating high fructose corn syrup and sugar from your diet, meditating every day for a month, going someplace you've never been once a week, etc., and stick to those commitments. I've noticed in my psychotherapy practice that people with low self-worth have problems with self-discipline and vice versa. One way to raise self-worth is to be sufficiently disciplined to have daily practices that you can be proud of accomplishing. Then, for number three, he says something that we referred to at the end of last week's program, that chasing money, power, sex, material possessions, bling, and so on, do not correlate strongly with happiness. We all know a lot of people who have more money than God and are still miserable, he says. Ironically, it turns out that givers are happier than takers in the long run. Being generous and helping others is infinitely more satisfying than looking at your bank account statements. Only an idiot wants richest guy in the cemetery on his tombstone. The only thing that correlates strongly with authentic happiness is trustworthy, positive, loving relationships. Being giving and generous helps build those relationships. Then, for number two, he has one word, authenticity. You create a false self, a facade, a persona to survive your childhood, and the defense mechanisms you developed became your way of being, your personality, he writes. There's a good chance that your facade personality is quite functional and even seductive. However, you know that underneath it lies an authentic self that is rather messy and unseemly. Relationships based on facades crumble, so you must be brave enough to be vulnerable. Show your authentic self and express yourself authentically and compassionately in order to cultivate vibrant, positive, loving relationships. And finally, he points to the present moment as the only moment we ever have. He says, if you say, yeah, I'll do these things like meditate, exercise, eat healthily, speak authentically, explore new places tomorrow, studies show that you will never do them. Happiness is a choice, and it's up to you to embrace a lifestyle and incorporate tools that will keep you at the top of your happiness range today. And not only is the today in caps, it is bold and in italics. I guess he's fairly serious about it. And with that, I think we've covered dissatisfaction pretty well in this and the last program. So now let's go on to the next of the six sufferings, the fact that we have to die again and again, which means, of course, that we have to go through being born again and again, and again and again. Namkapel writes, the bodies assumed by each sentient being have to be discarded. If their bones did not rot, they would be greater than Mount Meru. And he quotes Nagarjuna's friendly letter, which says, the heap of each sentient being's bones would equal or even be greater than Mount Meru. And the earth would be insufficient to count the number of one's mothers, with soil the size of juniper berries. Namkarpal goes on to quote a sutra, which states, O bhikkhus, if a person were to take pellets of earth the size of juniper berries, saying, this is my mother, this is my mother's mother, and so forth, as he casts them aside. O bhikshus, the soil of this great earth would soon be exhausted, but the series of that person's mothers would not. Now, I don't know what sutra this is, although the ancient text Gems of Dharma, Jewels of Freedom by Gompopa mentions a sutra named the Beginningless Time Sutra, which uses the analogy this way. The Shilekha says, if one reduced the earth to little balls, the size of juniper berries, their number would be smaller than the number of times any one being has been our mother. Bearing this carefully in mind, one cultivates the most sincere and wholesome attitude towards her. Then also the Mata Sutra, translated by Tanisaru Bhikkhu, says, at Svati, there the Blessed One said, from an inconstruable beginning comes transmigration. A beginning point is not evident, though beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving are transmigrating and wandering on. A being who has not been your mother at one time in the past is not easy to find. A being who has not been your father, your brother, your sister, your son, your daughter at one time in the past is not easy to find. Why is that? From an inconstruable beginning comes transmigration. A beginning point is not evident, though beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving are transmigrating and wandering on. Long have you thus experienced stress, experienced pain, experienced loss, swelling the cemeteries, enough to become disenchanted with all fabricated things, enough to become dispassionate, enough to be released. Basically, the Buddha is saying that if we could travel as far back as we want through our previous lives, we would never come to a first one. A beginning point is not evident, he says. And therefore, we would be traveling back endlessly through the billions of years of this planet's life to other planets, other universes, other planes of existence. On and on we would go. We would only be doing what we've already done, but in the opposite direction. Not that direction makes the slightest difference if we are not on the path to enlightenment. What does it matter if we go backwards or forwards, if we just continuously create the cause for more restless journeying in samsara and never come to rest? The point that Namkar Pal makes is that in all this wandering, we have died so many times that if someone had assiduously collected all our bones, the pile would now be higher than the fabled Mount Meru, the king of all mountains. Essentially, the pile of bones would rise endlessly up and up and would never reach a peak. Similarly, if we try to count all the mothers we've had, it would be impossible, for dividing this earth into small pellets the size of juniper berries and assigning each pellet to a mother we've had in a previous life, we would run out of pellets long before we'd run out of mothers. It's just another way of saying that we could never find enough pellets to cover all the mothers we've ever had. Now, what do you think about death, particularly your own death? Do you actually think about it? I know some people say they're not afraid of death, but who can really know until they're face to face with it? As Shakespeare said in Hamlet's most famous speech, "To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is noble in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. To die, to sleep, no more. And by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep. To sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come when we have shuffled off this mortal coil must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes, when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin? Who would these fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns, puzzles the will, and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of? Can we truly say that we do not fear that undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller ever returns? It's a bold statement indeed. Even if we firmly believe that there's nothing after death, aren't we even a little apprehensive about the process of death, the leaving of everything we're familiar with, and in particular, everything we're attached to? The agony of becoming weaker and weaker, increasingly confused and disorientated, perhaps with increasing pain and suffering. The going absolutely alone into the experience of the great oblivion. But if we are certain of life after this one, don't we feel at least a little dread of going somewhere much, much worse? I leave you to think about it, for we must now say farewell as our time together is up. Thanks for joining the program today, and I hope I haven't frightened you off for tuning in next week. Please dedicate the positive potential to the enlightenment of all beings as we usually do. Thank you, and goodbye.